Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Did you know that many products for pregnant women do not have their own clinical trials for safety or efficacy? That's because pregnant women are often excluded from clinical studies. Ritual is aiming to set a new standard with their essential prenatal multivitamin. It's the number one best-selling prenatal and the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Moms taking Essential Prenatal had a lower overall cortisol level during pregnancy than those taking a leading prenatal. Plus, it's designed to be gentle on the stomach. Ritual doesn't just have your back. They have the receipts. Get 25% off at ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey, welcome to Our Altered World. If you've been feeling overwhelmed by the giant that is climate change, you're not alone. I'm Neil, and here we celebrate the inspiring work of individuals and organizations making real positive strides that you may not have heard about. My hope is for our conversations here to make you feel inspired and reconnected to our planet. And with that being said, I would love to introduce Louisa from Marisette.
Hi, Neil.
Hi, Louisa. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me and my listeners today. I would love for you to tell them a bit about yourself and how you first became interested in marine mammal conservation and what inspired you to co-found Marisette in 2012.
All right. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here. So my name is Louisa Ponampalam. I am from Malaysia. I'm currently based in Malaysia, and I am the co-founder of the Marisette Research Organization, which is essentially the culmination of a lifelong childhood dream. And it basically began as a love affair and obsession with dolphins when I was about 13 years old. From a very young age, I'd spent many school holidays by the beach, by the sea. My parents would take us to the seaside during holidays. And even at 10 years old, I already fell in love with the sea. I loved the feeling of sand between my toes and the waves lapping up against my feet. And as a little girl, I remember looking out into the sea and telling myself, someday I don't want to be working just in an office. I want to have a job that brings me outdoors. And by the time I was a teenager, I grew obsessed with dolphins, and I was trying to find out more information about dolphins in Malaysia. This is in the 90s, so there wasn't like Google search and, you know, all these things at your fingertips at the internet, right?
Yes, just encyclopedias. Chock-a-block full of information.
Newspaper articles, magazines. And I couldn't find much information about marine mammals or dolphins in Malaysia, despite me being quite convinced at the time that I wanted to be that cool dolphin scientist that I'd just seen on the documentary on TV. Yeah. So then I realized that perhaps there is a niche for me to fill. Perhaps I could do something when I grow up. And from that moment on, I just decided that someday I would want to go and get my education, my university education abroad, learn the skills, and come back to Malaysia to build up this field of marine mammal science and conservation, and that someday I would build my own institute. At the time when you're 13, you just have these grand ideas without really understanding or knowing what they're really going to look like or how they're really going to pan out. But even as at that stage, I had already seen magazines where I was looking at articles relating to marine pollution, marine plastics pollution, and how it was affecting marine life. I still remember this article that had a picture of a leatherback turtle washed up on the shore, and it had plastic in its mouth. So I think for me, that was like on top of loving dolphins, that was quite a pivotal moment that I felt, this is it. I really want to study dolphins, but I want to protect the marine life and I want to protect the sea.
Yeah, you had so a visceral reaction to that photo, yeah, really driving you.
Yes.
Yeah, so and I just sort of chased this dream tenaciously. I chased it all the way till I was done with my PhD, where I studied spinner dolphins in the Arabian Sea. Then I returned back to Malaysia and I worked a little bit first, and then Marisat came along a little later, a year or two later. Yeah. But, you know, at the time in the 90s, because there wasn't any like volunteering opportunities for me to participate in, at least specifically for marine mammals, I had to go with my gut feeling, because was it just a passing phase, an obsession that I would eventually grow out of? Or was this really something I wanted to do for the rest of my life? So I just had to go with my gut feeling and go for it and go with it. Thankfully, my parents were very, very supportive. They still are. And it's sort of worked out. And, you know, many years later, here we are. I'm running Marisat full time.
What an incredible journey. I mean, how proud of your, like, your childhood embodiment would be to see like where you've come and that you've pursued this dream. And also, what an out of the box kind of passion that grew out of there. Usually kids are like, oh, I want to be a famous celebrity or a footballer or something, and you're like, no, actually, I want to save the world, I want to save all these marine mammals. And I, do you know what, I've found that tends to be the general gist, or the kind of passion that's been sparked up in most of the conservation leads or CEOs of all these NGOs that I've spoken to so far. It's always been a passion from childhood that sparked their connection with animals or the wider world, that's sort of driven them into this career path. Because let's be honest, there's not a lot of money here. We are not doing this for the money, guys.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly.
So The name is so unique. When I was coming across this, I was like, okay, so Marisat, like Mara as in the ocean and then set as in cetacean. And I was trying to derive this. How does this reflect the balance between marine conservation and scientific innovation that you kind of wanted to produce when founding your organization?
So when Fyro, my co-founder, and I were sitting down and toying with the idea of setting up my own NGO and then toying with names, we decided we didn't want to be so straightforward with the name, like Dolphin Protection Society or something like that. It just sounded a bit bland. So we thought, what kind of name can we give like a nice spin to? So when I was in university doing my bachelor's degree in Hawaii, I remember coming across some book. I can't remember what book it was, but I remember reading that mare is Latin for ocean, and then set is short for cetacean, which is basically what we started out with, studying mostly small dolphins. And so we thought, why not combine the two, mare set, to signify our focus, which is both on the sea, the ocean, as well as marine mammals. Of course, since our beginning till now, we have also branched into doing dugong research and conservation. So dugongs are not cetaceans, but essentially cetaceans, or the set in our name, is meant to symbolize the marine mammals that we work to study and protect, and the ocean being their habitat and that life sustaining body that supports so much of life on this planet.
Yeah. I don't think many people are going to be nitpicky about the fact that dugongs aren't cetaceans. They're like, it's fine, like you're still working with them.
Yeah.
It's in the marine. They're in the marine life. It's all good.
Exactly. It's got a forked tail. It's fine. They look similar-ish. Yeah.
Yes. So you've spoken about how you guys started off as this small research initiative, and you've now expanded out to wider marine life. What was the pivotal moment that started leading to your expansions and looking to become more of a comprehensive conservation NGO? And how have you found your strategy has evolved in these past 12, 13 years? Because science develops, as we've already mentioned, what it was in the 90s, and the access to information has grown exponentially. And even now with new technologies developing, that's obviously expanding our ability to carry out research and applied science so much better now that innovations have grown.
Yeah, so we started out very small and mostly research orientated, because one of the first stumbling blocks that we discovered was that many Malaysians do not know that we have whales and dolphin species of our own. And I owe this a lot to what we have grown up watching on media. There's never been an Asian television produced film or show that showed whales and dolphins. It's always been from the West. So things like
media is so important.
Yeah, Free Willy. So I think a lot of us grow up thinking that marine mammals are only found in the West, or Western countries. So we found that many Malaysians were shocked when they heard that we were going to study whales and dolphins in our country. It's like, what? There are whales and dolphins
where?
In Malaysia?
Yeah.
Really? Yeah. Yeah, lots of people just think that they are either lost from the Arctic or Antarctic, or just strays that are passing through.
Wow.
So that's when
so
we realized that the level of awareness is so low. So we started out small, and of course, we started out just with research. So when I was finally on the cusp of registering Marisa, I thought, okay, this is it. This is me being able to have my own thing, and I'm going to study dolphins for the rest of my life. Without knowing that actually running an NGO goes beyond research. It's about, you know, it's about dealing with people, working with people, and communications, and advertising, and you know,
yes,
putting yourself out there, etc.
An NGO is a complex business. It's a complex business that's striving for good, which makes it even harder because you're not looking for capital gains. You've got nothing to show an investor. Be like, we're going to make money. No, we might save this dolphin. We might.
Yes, exactly. You know, you got it spot on. So we started small and we didn't have any information. This was us starting from scratch. So for the first 2 years, we really focused just on doing research, on scientific research, because we also resolved from the beginning that we don't want to be a internet search kind of organization. Like if you were to ask me something about the dolphins here, I want to be able to tell you information derived from what we have observed ourselves. Even though we knew that the awareness levels were so low in our country, if we don't have information to share, then what can we really share? So we focused first on the research, and then eventually when we had amassed enough information, at least baseline information over the first 2 years, then we branched out into developing our marine education program in schools, in local schools. So then we started going into local schools to talk to students about the ocean and to tell them about the dolphins that we have, show them photographs, tell them a little bit about what are the conservation issues that are ongoing in our country and how they can help. So we started growing from there, a little bit from research, then it went in, you know, we started growing our education program. And then, but also through our research, we opened up volunteering opportunities for Malaysians to participate in our surveys. Because if you recall, I just mentioned that when I was that teenager, I didn't have a platform to figure out if this was something I really wanted to do. So we decided that Marisat would be a platform for people to experience what it would be like to do this work if they were interested into going into it, or if somebody just wanted to feel what it's like to do this work and to contribute to research and conservation. And also, Farah and I realized from early on that we will not be able to do this all by ourselves forever, because there's so much to do and someday we'll also be old.
The jobs just get bigger and bigger.
The next generation of people. Yeah. So it's a platform to build capacity. And then for me, doing science means that the scientific results have to be applied, which means that we're constantly translating our results into infographics and into materials for our education programs, for social media, but also to bring up as working papers to our governmental agencies to tell them, hey, we've done this research and we found that there's this issue that, you know, either contravenes with the law or is not covered under the law, but the dolphins are at risk. Maybe even the other stakeholders in the area are suffering. So perhaps we need to think of solutions. So inviting them to consider these recommendations and to work together to find a solution for better management, better conservation, and better enforcement of the law. Yeah. So it's basically slowly evolved into these various pillars. And over the years, we started, of course, from one field site. Now we have three main field sites, which also includes the dugongs. We've expanded our marine education program across the country. We've trained many volunteers. We've had many workshops to train local fishermen, coastal communities in how to respond to strandings. Yeah, and we started first with just two people sort of working full-time in the organization, and now we are a team of 11 staff members. So yeah, and what, you know, I think the turning point was perhaps first when I very fortunately was awarded the Pew Fellowship in Marine Conservation in 2014.
Congratulations.
Prestigious recognition of the work that we do. Yeah, and from there, I think that gave Marisat and myself visibility, and somehow the Wildlife Conservation Network found me and Marisat I think through the registry of the Pew Marine Fellows, and we got invited to go for a fall expo in San Francisco in 2019 to present ourselves. And from there, I think traction was gained for support for the work that we do here in Malaysia. And that has really allowed us to expand in terms of our team size and the complexity of the work that we do, geographic coverage, etc. Yeah. So we've also started integrating more technology now into our research, including bioacoustics, drones, genetics. Yeah. So it's we are 13 years old this year, and it's been a really long, long journey full of ups and downs. But I think we're somewhat fully formed now at 13 years old. And of course, there's always more space to grow at any given time.
Yes, you've just reached the adolescence now stage, the adolescent stage of the NGO. You've got so much room to grow, and so much is going to change, and the impacts are still ahead of you. So that was amazing to hear, Louisa. We're going to take our first break to hear from our station sponsors, and we'll be back with you all really soon.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Did you know that many products for pregnant women do not have their own clinical trials for safety or efficacy? That's because pregnant women are often excluded from clinical studies. Ritual is aiming to set a new standard with their essential prenatal multivitamin. It's the number one best-selling prenatal and the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Moms taking Essential Prenatal had a lower overall cortisol level during pregnancy than those taking a leading prenatal. Plus, it's designed to be gentle on the stomach. Ritual doesn't just have your back. They have the receipts. Get 25% off at ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with Louisa from Maricet. We just touched base on how the organization Maricet has grown since its founding in 2012, how it's expanded through education and raising generational awareness in Malaysia through education, leading to volunteers, and how that's led to expansion in the work that Maricet has done throughout the country and for marine life. Now, Louisa, climate change, the heavy topic, it's what we're all talking about and what we will be talking about for the next 20, 30 years, because we are at a pivotal point. And I really want to know, how is climate change altering marine ecosystems in Malaysia? You're there firsthand. I know you've got the knowledge about this. How is it affecting species like the dolphins and the dugongs? And what steps have you found that are working to build resilience?
Well, how can I answer this question? Because actually, I don't feel like we have enough data about climate change, even though we definitely feel it. It's much warmer these days. The weather has been more erratic. But also, we have a lot of other problems that are almost very obvious problems that are directly and very obviously impacting our marine ecosystems first and foremost. Overfishing, habitat degradation from coastal development, marine pollution, etc. It's almost hard, at least for marine mammals, it's almost hard to pinpoint how much climate change is affecting them, because these more immediate, very obvious threats are basically piled on.
Yes, they're all compounding, which is even worse.
Yes, exactly. So last year was a really warm year in Malaysia. I think the sea surface temperatures were exceptionally warm, and all the corals around our country were bleaching really terribly. And we don't work on corals, but when we spoke to local fishermen in the areas in our field site, many of them had said that they hadn't gone out fishing for months because there wasn't much fish to fish. And this sort of coincided the period of, you know, warm temperatures and coral bleaching as well. So it could be a combination of just the effects of overfishing, but also that the water was very warm and perhaps the fish had moved elsewhere. And so in relation to that as well, when we were out doing our surveys, encounter rates with the dolphins was also quite low. It was quite tough to try and spot them from on a day-to-day basis. So again, is it directly climate change being one of the factors, but also coupled with overfishing and issues relating to lack of prey resources? That is the sort of most obvious scenario that I could think of, where climate change was possibly impacting our animals. Yeah, but certainly I think we want to talk about building climate resilience. That's important, but where these animals are concerned, because they need to eat a lot to sustain their big body mass and their high energy requirements. Of
and what is a lot? What is a lot to a listener here? What would that equate to?
Well, I don't know exactly how much a dolphin eats in a day, a wild dolphin anyway. But okay, if we talk about dugongs, we know that dugongs need to eat between 50 to 60 kilograms of seagrass in a day. So I imagine dolphins that eat fish, prawns, squid, they would need to eat a substantial amount, you know, a few tens of kilograms as well per day to sustain their energy requirements. And even more so if they're in a reproductive state or post-delivery where they are nursing a calf, you definitely need to eat a few tens of kilos of fish and squid or prawn, whatever it is that you eat, to sustain your energy and to swim, to move through the water, to avoid predators, you know, to hunt, etc. It's basically, they need to eat a lot, and without food, they will leave the area. So is it overfishing that's driving the prey depletion down, or climate change causing the fish to move out of the area? Therefore, the dolphins are also moving out of the area. We don't have like exact information. But I guess what is safe to say is that human activities, intensive human activities all around, are impacting how animals are moving and where they are distributed. And certainly in certain places, probably the numbers as well. Animals are slowly maybe struggling to survive. So we definitely have seen a drop in encounter rates of the dolphins that we study on the West Coast in the state of Perak. And we think that it's attributed to a lack of food over the last decade, a decline in food resources over the last decade. So either they have slowly started dying out, or they've just moved away to look for greener pastures. So I think these everyday obvious problems are a challenge first, and that we need to try and find solutions for. Mm-hmm. Maybe alongside also finding a way to be resilient against climate change. But the fact is that there are these really compounding issues that are like right there in your face, that are eliminating animals from the population, that we need to deal with first.
You've mentioned a lot of these compound issues that we've just discussed. And I want to think about here, so beyond overfishing, what lesser known threats do marine mammals in these Malaysian waters face? How does Maricet address issues like underwater noise pollution from boats? For example, when I was in the Philippines, there was a big problem in Cebu, for example, with them feeding whales and going out with large number of tourist boats to whale sites, and that was affecting how the food chain was working in those areas, how those marine mammals were interacting with these boats, and how marine life as a knock-on effect was being affected in those areas. Is that a situation that takes place in Malaysia, or is there other threats that we may not know about that are taking place?
Okay, thanks for your question. That's a good one. Bycatch, so the accidental entanglement of marine mammals in fishing gear, is a global problem. And based on an international study that was published in 2023, it was found that Southeast Asia is one of the global hotspots with highest extinction risks for cetaceans in all of the world. And in another paper that was published in 2021 by a group of researchers, it was also found that some of the species that we study here in Malaysia, the finless porpoises, humpback dolphins, and Irrawaddy dolphins, are in the top 10 list of species, cetacean species, with the highest global bycatch risks. So bycatch is a problem. And in interviewing local fishermen here, we've also found that, yeah, some of them have had bycatch in their nets as they fish. These are artisanal coastal fishermen that we spoke to. So in 2023, we were able to secure some funding to start our bycatch mitigation trial project in the state of Para. We started working with some commercial fishers as well as local coastal artisanal fishers in trialing these acoustic pingers, this device that when it's in the water, it pings a sound of a certain frequency and loudness that is to alert the dolphins that, hey, there's a net here, stay away. Mm-hmm. So in that way, it's a win-win situation for both the dolphins as well as the fishermen. The animals remove or reduce their risk of getting entangled in a net, and the fishermen win because sometimes these dolphins come and steal fish from the nets. And when they do that, it causes damage to the fishermen's nets, which then causes them to have to fix it, which causes them time and money. So we're trying to find this win-win situation by working with local fishers to trial these and to give us feedback as to whether these pingers worked or not. So we gave them pingers with two different settings and let them try to tell us which one worked better and which one didn't seem to work, or the dolphins at first stayed away, but after a while they habituated to the sound and they were still coming close to the nets. Yeah. So far it's shown some positive results whereby the fishers who were given the pingers no longer reported bycatch in their nets versus their colleagues, their comrades who did not sign up for our trial program, who were still mm-hmm. getting bycatch in their nets. However, we were not able to test it on every species yet, and we've only tested it in one state, in one location.
What is the reception from these communities and these fishermen, fishing communities, when you come to them and say, hey, we would like to trial a program so that you reduce bycatch and we want to introduce this acoustic pinging? What is the general response from the...
So initially, when we were going around to the fishing villages and fish landing sites to introduce ourselves, naturally, people were a little bit suspicious of us and a little guarded because they thought that maybe we were just dressed up as plain clothes enforcement officers trying to catch them for maybe doing something wrong, or they had that perception, right? So at first, it was hard to introduce ourselves and explain ourselves. And so we tried a few different approaches, you know, making sure that we weren't dressed anything like an enforcement officer. We didn't carry anything that looked intimidating. And if we had a student with us, we'd say, oh, you know, this is part of a student's study. And so that put them at ease. And also we would explain that we are from a conservation NGO and we are trying to find win-win solutions. So we don't just want to be on the side of the dolphins or the porpoises, but we want to be on your side too. We want to help you prevent bycatch in your nets so that you don't have to deal with having to disentangle an animal and get your net damaged, broken, and etc. So at first it was tough, but luckily we had already, from our previous history of working in a certain fishing village, we had already known some of the fishermen, and these were the guys who were willing to give it a go.
Yes.
And many
so
of
like
the
word
others,
of mouth.
Yeah, word of mouth. And many of the others were like, oh, let him try first. If it works, I'll sign
okay.
on.
Okay, yes, yeah. I see.
So we were lucky.
Like, let him risk it.
Yeah, they can try and see what happens. If nothing happens, you know, if this is legit, then I'll sign on. So we are very lucky we had those few volunteers. And once word got out that it wasn't a hassle to attach the recorders to the nets, that it wasn't a trick and it wasn't a trap or anything, and that it worked, more people started signing on. And also we had these workshops. We conducted these community-centered workshops where we would again explain about the project. We would share some preliminary results with those who were participating in those trials for us and give feedback and have them give personal testimonials as well, and kind of just show the benefits through these workshops. And at these workshops, then more people felt empowered and motivated to sign up to join the trials.
With these workshops and education units, I was reading up about your Whales on the Wheels program. So I'd love for you to dive into what you guys did here, reaching over, I think it was 20,000 people. How do you find these education units reshaped perceptions, kind of how you reshaped perceptions with the fishermen and the fishing communities? How did that work with these rural coastal communities?
So we In the first year, because of the COVID lockdowns that had just been lifted up, we couldn't go to schools. Schools were still closed to outsiders. So what we did was we had our Whales on the Wheels. The full name is Whales on the Wheels Mobile Marine Education Exhibition. And we So we just call it WOW, Whales on the Wheels, WOW.
Yes. Yes, I like that. Wow.
Well, we took it on a nationwide tour, touring all the different states in Peninsular Malaysia. So in the first year, we mostly did it in public locations, either by seaside areas, in shopping malls, in the parking lots of public parks and places like that. Sometimes we would get to go to maybe like a private college and set up there. And it was amazing because, I mean, certain places did not have that many people come for various reasons. But in the places that we did have lots of people come through, everyone was amazed because inside our 3-ton truck that was decked up to become an exhibition hall, we had photographs plastered on the wall, all from photos that we'd taken from our research and outreach work. So there were these photos of Malaysian marine mammals on the wall that people were seeing for the first time. And you could see it in their eyes. It just blew their mind. This wasn't in Australia. This wasn't in the UK or the US or Florida. This was here in Malaysia, a whale, a pink dolphin, a finless porpoise. And then on top of that, we also had display of cetacean skulls. So like actual specimens that we collected with permission, of course, from the authorities, that we collected from stranded animals that stranded on the beach. So people were seeing what a skull of a dolphin looks like for the very first time. And it was like, wow, I didn't know that it was shaped like this. And look at all the teeth and teeth sockets. And then we also had like a soundboard where we had sounds of different marine mammals, including some that are not found here, like walruses and leopard seals that are not found in Malaysia. And so they can press the button and listen to the sound. My favorite is always just seeing their face, their facial expression, and how it just goes like it lights up, or it's like, whoa, what was that sound? Right? And some of the dolphin sounds on that soundboard were from the ones we recorded from our surveys. So it's very special to be able to say that was recorded in Malaysia.
Yeah.
They sound like this? Really? You know?
Yeah.
And then on top of that, we had, apart from the truck, we set up a canopy where there were also little booths for games and activities. And one of my favorite was the decomposition game, where we would put various types of non-breaking down, non-recyclable items, such as diapers, cigarette butts, tin cans and stuff. And we'll get the people or the kids to guess how long does it take to decompose. And some will say 5 years, 20 years. You know, when you flip the card around, it says 500 years. Boom, you just see their face.
Yeah.
It just explodes with like, whoa. And that's a moment of impact because it really puts things into perspective. 500 years? Nobody even really lives past 100 these days, right?
Yeah. And it doesn't even break down. It just breaks apart. It's still there. It's exactly. Just in tiny.
It's still there. Yeah, so lots of things are still, you know, around from time immemorial, right? So I think it really drives home the fact that, yes, we have marine mammals. And I think it inspired some people to go out and look for them in the wild. And of course, it inspired many people to perhaps think about their daily lifestyle choices in terms of using single-use items that are non-recyclable and non-reusable, etc. And we had a group of kids that came to our exhibition, the WOW exhibition, and 2 weeks later, one of the kids' father sent us an update. They had set up a booth at a weekend flea market to promote whales and dolphins in Malaysia and Marisette's work. And for me, that was like, wow, these kids came to our exhibition. They were inspired, and there they were setting up a booth at the flea market. They even dressed up as scuba divers. So they got two mineral water bottles and put it together like a knapsack, like as if they were going diving. And they had printed out all these photographs that they found with permission from us online from Malaysian dolphins and whales. And they became the eco guides for that weekend at that flea market, telling people all about marine mammals in Malaysia. So this is
that is so beautiful and so incredible. To hear, like, it must have, like, I don't know, like, swelled your heart to see that, you know, because it's almost like a reflection back to like you as a child, you know, having that passion and seeing you being able to instill that into this next generation, almost reflecting back this new brigade of conservationists. Hats off to you. I love that.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I mean, so those were the times that we were doing it in the public space. And then after that, we were able to move to schools because that was the original plan, to go to local Malaysian schools, especially in rural coastal areas. Because what I discovered from working in some of these island field sites is that even though these kids are born and raised on an island, and some of them might be the children of fishers, they actually don't spend that much time by the sea for some reason or the other. And how can they appreciate what's in their backyard if they didn't have that exposure? So taking the whale truck to the schools was really nice because all the kids would get so excited learning about the difference between a dolphin and a shark, or learning that they have this species just, you know, down the beach down there behind their village. And then, of course, learning about the issues relating to marine conservation and how they, as junior citizens of the planet, can contribute. And some even went on to make like sketches and drawings. The teacher would send us an update and say, hey, my student drew this after attending your exhibition. So I think it definitely has sort of opened people's minds and given exposure to these children about what they have in the sea. Because I could have chosen to study any marine life in the sea. It could have been turtles, it could have been fish, it could have been plankton, right? But I love dolphins, and that's how this started. But also, in the bigger picture, marine mammals do act as indicators of the ocean health. When they are gone, when the fish is gone, they will also leave. So they're very obvious when they are not around. And so we use them as I mentioned just now, with, you know, the overfishing and warm temperatures. The dolphins didn't seem to be around, and that's when we knew something's wrong. So they're very obvious. So we use them as that mascot to promote conservation. And I think using them as a mascot for our marine education program as well is just the same kind of impact, right? They represent survival of the blue planet, which really gives to so much of life on Earth. And I always ask people, if you just close your eyes for a second, can you imagine living in a world without dolphins swimming the sea or without whales swimming in the sea? And for me, that would be, I mean, the world will go on, we'll live, but it just feels sadder not to know that,
yes,
to know that these animals are not out there anymore.
100%.
Yeah. Yeah.
One less beautiful creature in the ocean. Yeah, I feel like you would be impacted by that. Now, Louisa, thank you so much for that quick dive through onto your incredible program. We're going to take another quick break and we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with Louisa from Maraset. She just walked us through her incredible Whales on Wheels, wow, education program that reached all of these rural coastal communities in Malaysia, and even instilling the next generation of conservationists that are showing up at flea markets telling other people how they should be looking after the oceans. How lovely was that to hear? Now, Louisa, a topic that we often touch base on here at Our Altered World is ecotourism. Now, ecotourism is growing in areas like Langkawi, which I visited. I loved the island, but I can definitely see how ecotourism could be damaging the island, its environment, the way that tour operators are operating in the area, for example. I'd love to know how Maraset ensures things like dolphin watching tours benefit wildlife and local economies without actually causing harm.
I'm so glad to hear that you've visited Langkawi. Langkawi is the first place where we landed on for project.
I traveled Malaysia for like nearly 2 months back in 2016.
Wow. Okay. Yes. Cool. Yeah, nice. Yeah, well, Langkawi has a special place in my heart and in that of my teams. It's like a second home. I know it so intimately. And, you know, there is that general perception about Langkawi, but then we've been able to see her natural beauty because we work in and around all the different islands. And yes, definitely tourism has boomed in the last few decades in Langkawi. In fact, at the start of the lifts of the COVID quarantine, Malaysia made Langkawi as a tourism bubble. So if you wanted to travel, you can travel to Langkawi. Not anywhere else, but Langkawi. So of course that, you know, suddenly for 2 years, there was nobody coming. And then suddenly, boom, lots of people again.
Massive influx, yes.
Yeah, and
because that happened to those famous Thai islands, they had such an influx, they had to shut them down again. They were like, no, you can't come here anymore. But I've yet to see Malaysia do anything like that.
Not yet. Yeah, I mean, it closed down because of COVID. So before that, there was a lot of tourists. And then now again, it's sort of business as usual. I think that we need to promote more ecotourism in its truest sense. I think a lot of people throw the word around ecotourism a lot, but it doesn't actually, in practice, it's not ecotourism. It's maybe
just
tourism or just mass tourism. Because ecotourism needs to
be greenwashed tourism.
Yeah.
Yes.
Give back to the local economy, but also to locals and to locally managed operations, right?
So now, important.
Yeah. So as far as dolphin watching goes, actually in all of Malaysia, there isn't actually any dedicated dolphin watching industry except in Kuching in Sarawak, where there are dolphin-focused tours. In Langkawi, if people see them on a mangrove tour, for example, boatmen will stop for a while for the people to appreciate the dolphins and then move on to the next place. So currently, we do certain trips where we take small groups out to look for the dolphins in the areas where we know where they are. But also, I think in a way, it'd be hard for Langkawi to have a steady dolphin watching industry because from the data that we've gathered over the last decade, the dolphins are not in the same two places every day. And sometimes they're not in the typical mangrove tour or tourist boat route. So it'll be very hard to sustain in that sense. People will go out and then not see dolphins and might feel disappointed. So in a way, that has helped keep the dolphins safe. However, during the times where we have seen the dolphins within the main tourism route area of the mangrove tours and whatnot, and boats do start stopping to see the dolphins, there have been times of overcrowding. I remember a time where we counted about 67 boats just coming and going within like an hour.
Oh.
With the dolphins, yeah. And some of them speed at a really high speed and they almost ram into the group or break the group apart. And it's very stressful, especially if calves are present. So at the moment, for the last 2 years, we have been working on trying to find a way to establish some kind of boating code of conduct around the dolphins. We've had some roundtable discussions with the local tourism operators, business owners, as well as the governmental agencies to vet what is the interest for having such a guideline. Would people object? Would they feel like it's threatening their business? Or
on the surface, it seems like something that would be so easily achieved. But just as you mentioned, there's so many bodies that you have to consider, the operators, the governments, the NGO organizations, and the financial aspects of all of this stuff as well. Like they're all technical businesses, you know, the government has to think of the tourists, the local tour groups have to think about their economy, how much money they're making. And then you've got the conservation side of it coming in while we're looking at the animals, and all of it is, again, compounding. We've talked about different compounding effects earlier, compounding business problems now as well.
Yeah, exactly. So we would, I think at the surface, maybe some operators think that this is going to be very prohibitive for them because they don't really want to have to slow down, because some of them say their tourists want to go fast and like the thrill of a speeding boat. Also, because it's a tour that involves various locations, so they don't want to have to slow down and that delays the entire trip and things like that. So we were trying to find a way to see how can we introduce this into the local tourism industry there, even if voluntarily, even if we could not make it something that was official, but if we could have people just be more mindful. So we're currently working on infographics and visual materials that we would like to print out to put up signages at jetties, waterproof stickers that we can put on the boats of these operators and distribute it to tourists. And hopefully, we also interviewed some tourists last year to ask what their opinion is about boats slowing down when they see dolphins, and most people were in support. So we're hoping that if we're able to also get these visual materials out to the tourists who go on these trips, mangrove trips and things like that, and if they see a group of dolphins and if they find that their boatman is perhaps just speeding right through, they themselves would have had enough information to request for the boatman to slow down. Please, we would like to experience and enjoy the dolphins without harming them or disrupting them and things like that. So it's still a work in progress because, as you mentioned, there's so many layers. We've got the legislation to consider and then people's own buy-in, all the stakeholders. The thing is, we want the tourism to prosper, but in a sustainable way, right? So that Langkawi's tourism will be for many years to come. And of course, we also want to care about the dolphins' welfare. So it's about finding that balance and getting the message across that we're not here to disrupt operations or businesses, you know, and we just want win-win situation for the animals that live in this area where tourism is also very busy. But we want you to be able to continue, but in a sustainable way. And hopefully with that, your guests who are on board also have a nice experience and the dolphins will be around for many years to come for many repeat customers. So it's finding that balance and getting that message across that we're still working on, because definitely there is some resistance. People will think that this might be cumbersome to their businesses. Yeah.
Yes. But as you said, you are still working on, which I love. Now, Louisa, your team have made quite a few exciting discoveries over the past 13 years that you've been doing this. Can you talk us through a few of these? And also, what has been your proudest achievement with Maraset, whether it's in the 5 years or the length of the time that you've been working to do the incredible work that you have?
Thank you for that question. When I look back our beginning, and I'll tell you a little bit about our beginning, when we first started Maraset, it took 2 years for Farrell and I to sit on that idea because we thought we needed to have a lot of money to open up an NGO. Then later on, we found out that we only needed 30 ringgit. Our currency is ringgit, Malaysia. 30 ringgit to start our organization. So he gave 15 ringgit and I gave 15 ringgit. And then, bam, we registered it. But next came us having to open a bank account for the NGO. And you need to put in a certain amount to start a bank account. And at the time, we were just starting out in our careers as well. And we didn't have all that much money and we didn't want to trouble our parents. So we decided that we would, over 6 months, gather everybody's junk that they no longer wanted, whether it was pots and pans, shoes, clothes, books, toasters, whatever, right? Golf clubs. And we collected all these items from friends and families and their neighbors to hold a garage sale, so that we could raise the funds to put that money into our bank account to be able to open the bank account. My mom nearly chased. I was living with my parents at the time still, and my mom threatened to chuck me out of the house because of all the junk that was accumulating in the house. And I had to plead with her. I said, "Mom, just a few more weeks and we're going to have this garage sale. Please just let me stay." Yeah, so fortunately, she didn't throw me out. Yay. So when I look back to those days where we were literally selling other people's unwanted items to raise funds to where we've come today, we're a team of 11, we're doing okay financially in terms of being able to sustain our operations. We've got projects all over the country. We've got a great following. I mean, it's been
from humble beginnings to global impact. Wow, I'll give you a round of applause there.
I'd like to think that, yeah. And I think for me, it's just seeing that growth and the team that we have grown as well. Some of the team members that we have today, the staff at Maraset, started with us when they were just in their undergraduate study days as volunteers, and they came back repeatedly as volunteers. Some of them went on to pursue their PhD, co-supervised by myself, and today they work at Maraset with me to grow our work and our missions. For me, that's, you know, remember when I said that one of the things was Maraset was built as a platform for capacity development. That's, for me, one of the success stories, that we have people who have been with us now for more than 10 years and just grown and evolved in that role. And also all the work that we've done and getting it recognized, our field sites recognized as IUCN Important Marine Mammal Areas. These are internationally recognized areas of importance. I think that's something really, really proud. And for us to have somehow been found by the WCN network and to become a part of that global network. I always sit and think there's so many organizations all over the world doing important work on endangered species. Yet in this big sea of so many, we got identified as one that would be part of this network. And for me, that's always such an amazing moment. Of course, certain awards that we've won locally and internationally, that is a recognition of our hard work. But also just the impact, the feedback that we've gotten, testimonials that we've gotten from people who have volunteered with us, who have come on our excursions, whether it's kids or adults alike, who have told us that joining us was such a life-changing experience. I mean, to me, that's so fulfilling, even more fulfilling than even like winning an award, because that reminds me that this is why we do the work that we do. Even on days when I feel beat up, flat, maybe with nothing left to give, and I think back to these testimonials, or suddenly I'll receive one, it just makes me feel like this was all worth it in the end. Yeah. So yeah, so many things to be proud of, but yeah.
As you should, Louisa, what a beautiful and incredible, fulfilling journey you have been on here. Now, we are having to wrap up on our conversation here today, and I'm so sad because there was so much more I'd have loved to have spoken to you about, so we're definitely going to have to try and find a time to get you back on this show at some point. Yeah. But I'd love for you to end on a final message of hope about protecting Malaysia's marine diversity.
Okay, well, Malaysia sits at the center of marine biodiversity, and marine mammals are part of that biodiversity. There's so much that the ocean offers to us, and there's so much beauty and relaxation that the ocean can give us as well. And I think that it's so worth to protect it, because not only is protecting the sea or the ocean, it's not just an ocean hugger's job or something that ocean huggers do. But I always say protecting the sea means protecting our own future. Because if the sea is not well, it cannot provide for us. So perhaps even if you're not exactly a sea or ocean enthusiast, I would say give it a thought about your own future and have that desire to protect your future. In doing so, you would protect the ocean. Yeah. So yeah, and get out there and experience the power of the ocean for yourself. And we welcome people to come volunteer with us or experience one of our trips, and hopefully that could be.
And where can they find you? Where can they find you, Louisa?
We are on Instagram at Mariset, that's the handle, and we are on Facebook, TikTok, yeah, and we have a website, www.mariset.org. So yeah, come find us. We are, or just Google us, and I think they'll show up.
Amazing. Louisa, thank you so much for talking with me today, and thank you everyone for listening to Our Altered World. If you enjoy the show, I'd love for you to visit our website, ouralteredworld.com, where you can join our community and find more information on upcoming shows. You can also find some of my work on social media at Flunking Monkey, FlunkingMonkey. And until next time, I hope you all have a great day.